same thing back in the cold. People know.
Hi, I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Shauna Pacifico.
And you are listening to The Main Course on the Heritage Radio Network. What a nice morning, Shauna.
Yeah,
and
it's beautiful over here at Roberta's.
Shauna, you're sitting in for Katie Kiefer, who's usually
the
Main Course co-host. And it was really nice because I got here at 11 and we had breakfast and it was delicious.
Really good. Very good baked eggs and a porchetta sandwich. Good mimosas.
We had pitchers of mimosas.
That's
not sustainable for the bartender anyway. No, it was pretty good. I had the porchetta sandwich, which
was really
super
good.
Delicious.
Very good.
So you are the chef of Back 40,
one of my
favorite places.
Yes.
And of course, like if you do the search for jowl, you come up like 10 times because Shauna is the only chef in America, or certainly in New York, that makes these delicious jowl nuggets.
Cheeky McNuggets.
I mean, you could eat 50 of those.
You can eat 50 of those.
One can, I meant.
No, you probably can eat 50 of those. Not advisable to eat 50 of them, but they're pretty delicious and scrumptious, I would say.
How do you get them to get into the ball?
Well, they're actually little cubes, and we cut them. We braise them, and we press them so that when they're hot and they get pressed, they all become the same size.
Mm.
And then we cut it and bread it and then deep fry it. Nothing like deep fried fat.
That helps. I mean, jowl nuggets are deceptively
But good. I just read in the Defense of Food, and it was talking about how, you know, some fats are good when they come from good pork, which my pork jowls come from you, so it's not bad fat.
I don't know the scientific thing, but like I think vitamin E, if you're a free-range pig, the sun hits you and that creates vitamin E. So vitamin E is very important. Hold on. We're going to cut to a sponsor break.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
That's right. Just in case you didn't hear, that's Joe Bastianich.
And this is Heritage Radio Network.
Yeah, and we're here at Roberta's. It is a lovely place. Now they have that whole back area.
It's nice. It's nice and tented. I last time I was here, I definitely got a sunburn sitting out here. But now that there's a tent, nice and cool underneath that tent.
Totally. Well, I'm excited about the show. Shauna, you invited, who are our first guests?
Flying Pigs Farm. That's Jen Smalls and Mike Yezzi. We've been buying pork from them since the beginning. Savoy, our other restaurant's been buying pig from them since the beginning that they've been. I don't quite know off the top of my head when they started, but they're, you know, husband wife team, and they run a really great farm.
That's amazing.
And they sell in the Union Square Farmers Market and also Brooklyn, I think.
Okay. And what kind of breeds do they raise?
They have the Tamworth,
mm-hmm.
the large black,
okay,
and the you have to help me with the pronunciation.
Gloucester Old Spot.
Yes, that one.
Those they have a real small region of England is home both to actually all three of those pigs.
Oh, really?
Yeah, I think they were like kind of orchard kind of pigs. Like the large black, I know its ears go over its eyes.
That's actually the I want to get a tattoo of a pig.
And you want the large black?
I want the big floppy ears.
That's really nice. The concept of like orchard pigs are so amazing. Uh-huh. I think the red bottle that we sell a little bit of is was the orchard pig of New Orleans, mm-hmm. in the 17th century. So pretty interesting.
Yes.
And then following them, it's actually very interesting parallels. We have Mario Fantasma, the patriarch of Paradise Locker Meats, which is, among other things, where Heritage Foods, slaughters its pigs, 150 a week. Oh, and by the way, this is for our producer, Heather Hyman. They bought a sponsorship. But we have to make them the only guests
there
today.
There is cheering in the background.
We have to cancel Flying Pig, though. That's the only... No, just kidding. And Heather Hyman is our producer, and EJ Dikoski is our engineer. Good job, EJ.
You should have the clapping.
Why am I getting texts that no one can hear the live stream? Just kidding. Anyway, well, it's very exciting. Heath, how much longer do we have on the intro before we get 4 minutes? All right, time for a sound effect.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
Have you had Sam Edwards's hams?
I haven't. I haven't had it in the restaurant.
They had this nice article about Sam Edwards in the New York Times, and it said that, like, or he said that there used to be, like, I think 500, 600 famous or, you know, well-known regional cure families or whatever, or companies. And now there's like 8.
Oh, really?
10. There's like Newsom's, Benton's, you know,
there's
Armandino Batali, La Quercia. I mean, you can count them on your hands. Framani just opened.
But is that about them expanding and taking over the 300 small ones that...
No. It's just them sticking into their little... I mean, Al Benton's is like a shack in Maryville, Tennessee. Sam Edwards has very modest... he has 2 stores, though, which are really cool.
Oh, okay.
I think Armandino Batali, I mean, he can't even take on new customers. Mm-hmm. You know, he has such small production, but...
Well, good for them for sticking in and producing us with some good,
like,
pork.
Yeah, it's like, this was like a shakedown, it seems. You know, like, this whole economic downturn was like a shakedown.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, only the capable, not even the strong. Even if you were capable, you survived.
Well, no, not even some capable are not surviving or having a hard time, so.
Well, like, GM, like, they were losing millions of dollars. Like, it's right that some shakedown...
Absolutely.
Stops grandfathering those policies in, you know. But Heritage barely made it, but we survived, so.
That's a good thing.
Should we get a sound effect for that?
There we go. Ooh, go Heritage.
Wait a second. So, and then finally, we're going to have Kim Mueller on.
Kim Mueller.
Who I really like. I met her at Slow Food Nation. Did you go to Slow Food Nation?
I didn't.
She is in Santa Fe, which is a... Have you ever been to that part of the country?
I haven't been to anywhere over there.
It's like...
Been to California, but...
It's like desert.
That's what they say.
Yeah, I know. I mean, think about that food-wise. Like, we work with the Tohono O'odham. Like, they suck syrup out of cacti.
Really?
Yeah.
Hmm.
I mean, it's hard living out there.
I'm sure it is. I know people that have left New York to go live there and then come back a couple years later.
Well, talking of breeds, I think Texas Longhorns do well in that type of desert environment.
That's good for them. It's hot.
I don't know if they taste good. Are they a meat breed? I would think probably not. The meat breeds are more like the lush.
There's a Texas Longhorn steakhouse, isn't there?
There must be. Yeah. So I might be full of.
I don't know. I mean, that's barely a steakhouse, I guess.
What about wolf?
Wolf.
Have people ever eaten wolf?
I have a mini wolf, a mini little Japanese wolf, so I hope people don't eat wolves.
Oh my God, how old is your dog?
My dog is a year and a half. Yes, he's a Shiba Inu.
Shiba Inu?
Yeah.
How much does a Shiba Inu weigh?
He weighs 25 pounds, 27 because he's a little pig, but they're like a small breed and a big breed. Mind.
Yeah. I have 2 Scottish Terriers who are kind of, I mean, those are rare breeds too. I mean, now we're a minute away. Hold on. The sun is glaring. Heather is jumping up and down. How many syllables? 60 seconds.
We're going to be talking to Jen and Mike.
Yeah.
From Flying Pigs Farm.
I know. It's super awesome. And, you know, it's talking about these dogs, you know, with pedigrees and all that. Uh-huh. Like, why wouldn't meat that we eat have that
Jesus,
I'm sorry. Hold on.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
Pretty awesome.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Esposito's. www.espositosausage.com.
Scratch that, it's Edwards. Hold on.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Hearst Ranch. www.hearstranch.com.
That's actually incorrect. At the end of this, we will roll in.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network.
This is the real one.
Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com. Thank you.
I could be with anyone, so all the honeymoon burns bright. No electricity that keeps things light, and I'm not saying that it's right, or saying that it's always right. I'm just saying that it's not a lie. I could talk to anyone, care just enough about her wounded pride, her ballerina dreams and lead foot life, her sugar daddy and his clueless wife. And I know that it's not right, I just don't always know how or why. 'Cause I could stick to anyone, at least for a little while. A caffeinated string of cartoon smiles, and conversation sharp and deep, a tempting sample of who I could be, without the broken glasses waiting underneath. So I'd walk soft if I were you. You could cut up your feet, for now it's just what I am, but it's not what I'll be.
And welcome back to the Heritage Radio Network. This is the main course. And right now on the phone, we are going to talk to the farmers at Flying Pigs Farm, Jen Smalls and Mike Yezzi. Hello, are you there?
Hi, Shauna.
Hi, how are you?
Hi, Shauna.
Hi.
Hey, Jen and Mike.
Patrick.
This is Patrick Martin from Heritage Foods. I don't know if you guys are acquainted, but...
Well, you have one of my favorite people working with you right now, Aaron Fitzpatrick, who...
Fairbanks.
Oh, my God. Why did I just say that? Aaron, who used to work with my business partner in Ann Arbor, Michigan. She was one of the founders of our wholesale business.
Aaron's great.
By founder, I mean she made deliveries with me in the back of a U-Haul.
So can you tell us a little bit about Flying Pigs Farm, where you guys are, what, how many pigs you have?
Sure. Michael and I have a pig farm in gorgeous Washington County, New York, about 200 miles north of the city. We raise rare breeds of pigs outdoors on pasture and in our woods, and we sell to restaurants in New York City, like Savoy and Il Buco and Gramercy Tavern and Diner and Back 40, of course, Shauna, and Moss and Telepan and a few others. We also sell at the Farmers Market in New York City at Union Square on Fridays and Saturdays and at Grand Army Plaza on Saturdays. And we also ship mail order across the country, our pork across the country, to the folks all over the place who appreciate rare breeds of pork and are helping to protect the genetic diversity of livestock breeds.
Well, that's what our show is really about today, the rare breeds. And what kind of breeds are you carrying there? Are you growing?
We're raising.
Raising.
We're raising four breeds of pigs. Three. They're all rare, and the Tamworths are, according to the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy, threatened. There's 500 registered in North America, and a worldwide population of less than 5,000. And then the large black Gloucestershire Old Spots and Assabaugh Island pigs are endangered, and though critical rather, and that means there's fewer than 200 registered in North America and a worldwide population of fewer than 2,000.
We have got to do something about that.
A little sound effect for that.
Well, actually, I had a question relating to that. The second and final guest of the show, besides you guys, is Mario Fantasma, who also owns a slaughterhouse, and he slaughters Tamworths. So I was going to see if we could like make a connection, and maybe you talk a little bit about what that breed is like, its personality, its energy on the farm, and how that differs from other breeds, be it commodity or other rare breeds.
Sure, we can talk about some of the differences between those breeds. There's behavioral differences. Each breed sort of has its own personality. The Tamworths are a little longer legged. Their ears are straight up, so they have a better field of vision. They're redheads with red in color and have all sort of the stereotypical redhead characteristics. They're very gregarious, outgoing. They're always ready to test the fence and see if it's hot or not, and if not, go out for a party with the gang down the road and into the neighbor's flower bed.
How often does that happen that you're gathering your pigs that have escaped?
It seems to be a spring ritual. You know, when it gets a little muddy and the outside of the fence does look a little better than the inside, they tend to go for a walk.
And how much space do they have in the fence? How much space running around?
It depends on the number of pigs, but you know, each pen is an acre and a half or a couple acres.
That's big.
And you know, we move them regularly so that they always have fresh ground. They spread their own manure, forage for, you know, grass and roots and bugs and nuts, and turn over the vegetation, fertilize it, and move on, and it grows back. And then they're followed by our meat chickens and our eggs.
A holistic farm.
Yeah.
Now, tell us about the large blacks. I know it has big ears that hang over its eyes. So does that mean it's lazy or not curious?
Not lazy. They're good mothers. They are good foragers. But because they have the lop ears, and they've been bred to be a little bit more docile, as have the Gloucestershire Old Spots, which are sort of your storybook pink pig with big black spots on them, also called the orchard pig. So they've been bred to be a little more docile so that they don't destroy the bark and the apple trees or the fruit trees. So, but just, you know, glean the dropped fruit in the fall. So these are a little easier going. They learn where the fence lines are, and they don't like crossing to the next pen, even though you take down the fence. They know where the boundaries are, and they take a little encouragement, usually by the leadership of the Tamworths, to get across the line. They can't see as well because their eyes are, you know, over there. Their ears, rather, are over their eyes, partially.
So I always thought that Tamworth was like Spanky from the Little Rascals, you know? He's that little red-haired, like, could live in New York City. Now, these rare breeds, I mean, do they, I mean, what is the greatest, I mean, do they get along amongst themselves? I mean, is there general camaraderie? What's their social dynamic on your farm, like all your pigs together?
They all get along, but they do tend to, you know, sort of at the end of the day, litter mates will wind up back in the huts together. The birds of a feather do flock together to a certain extent. And the pigs do establish a hierarchy, a sort of pecking order, who gets to get to the feed trough or the water whenever they want, and, you know, who has to wait in line. And they establish this between and among the breeds, and but everybody gets along. You'll walk up to a hut, and there will be, you know, all of the pigs from the different breeds, you know, maybe in a hut, or maybe all Tamworths or all large blacks.
It would be interesting to look back where these breeds were developed for the first time and see, like, if the terrain of where the Tamworth was bred first, you know, was very different from the terrain where the large black or the Gloucester, and so they bred, you know, what were the reasons?
It most likely was probably different.
Yeah.
There's a lot of information online at the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy website, and that website is www.albc-usa.org, and we work very closely with the American Livestock Breeds Conservancy. They conduct an annual census of rare breed livestock, not just pigs, but cattle, donkeys, rabbits, poultry. And their census and their website provides a lot of information about where people can go to learn more about the heritage and background of these very old breeds of pigs. They are an important part of our agricultural history, and to promote this diversity is important. I compare it to dogs. You were talking about dogs mm-hmm. earlier. It would be a boring world if every dog was the same, if everything was a black lab, much as I love black labs. Just as there are different breeds of dogs with very distinct personalities and traits, like the webbed feet of a golden retriever, for example, is an important trait for a swimming dog, each of these rare breeds of livestock are also very important, and it's important we preserve this genetic diversity.
Which dog is this? That's a genetically modified
dog. That's a cat.
Dog. That's a Monsanto. Oh, that's a cat.
So what do you say that what needs to be done for us to continue to preserve these rare breeds, and where do you think, and Patrick and I were talking earlier, in 150 years?
No, you added both together. I said 100. You said that's too much. So okay. I said 50. Now
so
you 50 say
years. So in 50 years, where will rare breeds be?
And where how do we get there? Where will your farm be? I'm really interested in your farm. Like, not 10 years, but like in 100, 150 years, how will it look, you think? What's your prediction for posterity?
I think we're doing very well on some of these breeds in particular. The Tamworth is almost out of the woods in terms of its preservation. So the Tamworth is becoming increasingly common, and I think it's because it is, compared to the other rare breeds of pigs, it's a fairly efficient pig. The Gloucestershire Old Spot is having a lot of difficulty right now. We, in fact, work with breeders throughout the Northeast to raise piglets for us, and we, frankly, go out of our way for our Gloucestershire Old Spot breeders. They're having more trouble because there are so few left that there are breeding problems. There are so few in North America, maybe a couple hundred, that oftentimes they're related. So they're having litters of maybe 4 piglets. That compares to a confinement operation of maybe 11 piglets.
Wow.
So you can imagine the cost of keeping that sow and that boar over the course of a year. Combined, you might produce 8 piglets. That's it. And that's a very expensive way to raise animals. So one is people should have patience, I hope, with rare breed livestock and understand that they are more expensive to raise. They are going to cost more. But you are actually protecting a breed of animal when you buy from them. So I think that Gloucestershire Old Spots, we still have a ways to go. Large blacks, we still have a ways to go. But Tamworth is out of the woods. We've seen a tremendous comeback in the last 8 years. When we've only been doing this for 9 years, and when we started, I think we knew every single rare breed breeder in all of the Northeast. And we're meeting now new ones every day. And that's very exciting for us. It would be really interesting, and we'd consider it a sign of success if we just lost our niche, to be honest with you. If what we were doing stopped being unique, we would consider that a success.
So how many pigs do you have, and where? At what point do you think that you may be getting too big?
Yeah, where do you guys draw the line
to move to the next another farm or start something else?
Mm-hmm. We have about 200 acres on our farm, and we've raised about 500 pigs over the past couple of years. So in the past couple of years, we've done about 500 pigs a year, in addition to our laying hens and meat chickens, and are not, you know, utilizing all of the potential space on our farm. We use the pigs to help renovate pastures that are starting to be overtaken, and there are still some areas that we haven't even been able to put the pigs on yet. So plenty of room for expansion. The toughest part is getting enough, working with breeders to get enough piglets to meet the demand. It's sort of one of the ironies of rare breed preservation is that these are meat animals, so the best way to preserve them is to eat them and to show people the great characteristics, the marbling, the dark color, the rich flavors they get from pasture raising, and that by creating a demand, the breeders are able to put on more breeding stock, which is really what preserves these breeds. And so I think you're talking about where are they going in the future. I think as people start to appreciate the quality of the rare breeds and the importance of the biosecurity and biodiversity that breed preservation provides, then people will, I think these breeds will start to increase in popularity. And I think people, but it's a more expensive way to raise pigs. The yields aren't the same. They aren't in confinement. It's a more humane way of raising pigs. And so I think people, as the cost goes up, people might be eating a little less meat, but a higher quality, more flavorful meat, and preserving these breeds.
And we will have effectively removed ourselves from people who have these birds flying overhead.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite sound effects, by the way. I might use it again. But I did want to ask, before we ask you about your farm camp, I did want to ask you both, if the urban farming movement, or when it takes off, what livestock would you most recommend that urban farmers embrace? And if it's pigs, like, which breed do you think would be the most apt to service an urban farming movement?
You know, Patrick, I don't really see pigs in an urban environment.
Well, didn't they used to live on the streets of London?
You know, we take First Avenue home every Saturday night, and I'll tell you, a pig could probably tear up First Avenue much more quickly than the crews are that are currently renovating it and putting down new paving.
Right.
So I don't recommend pigs in the city whatsoever. Plus, they need a lot of space to run around in. But I do think it would be great if everyone kept, you know, four or five or six chickens for eggs.
Uh-huh.
They're very simple. They're a great way for kids to learn about food because it's immediate. There's an egg there every morning, warm and ready for breakfast.
What about goats?
I just saw goats in Cape Coral, Florida.
Or are you guys making the case that no livestock should be raised, even in the big kind of empty lot yards? You think it's agriculture or meat protein growing should stay in the countryside, kind of, on the farms?
Not at all. I mean, I I think that pigs tend to be a little more unruly, but goats would be fantastic, or even sheep would be fantastic to keep in the city. Bees, of course. I think Just Food is doing a tremendous job right now trying to legalize beekeeping in New York City. But if people want to get started with farming on a small scale when it comes to livestock, I think egg-laying chickens is the way to go.
And I think one of the greatest pictures agriculture history of New York City is seeing sheep on the sheep meadow. That's why it's called the sheep meadows, because they used to have sheep grazing.
Let's just let 10 sheep loose.
Well, every once in a while somebody will come up to me at Grand Army Plaza and they'll say, you know, they'll tell me about the rooster that's running around Prospect Park that somebody, you know, had in their backyard or
conservationists
somehow got loosened, that they're, you know, people tell the stories of feeding these escaped chickens. So there are people who have backyard chickens in Brooklyn and rooftop beehives in Manhattan and all the boroughs.
So crossing over from the urban to the farm, you guys are starting a program called Farm Camp, I believe?
The New York State Department of Agriculture and Markets has provided us with a grant to start something called Farm Camp for Food Professionals. It's actually an agritourism grant. Michael and I have always believed that New York City chefs and food writers are the tastemakers for the country. And we think that the way to influence the local food scene is to engage them as much as possible. So we will be having people in the food industry, whether that's front of house wait staff or managers or cooks or chefs, come up to our farm for seminars and farm tours. And they'll see, it's not just about Flying Pigs Farm, they'll see all of the great things in Washington County. We have cheesemakers who are fantastic. We have berry producers, great grass-fed meat up here.
New York State is very well, it's a very grass state, like Vermont, right? There are not that many other states in the Northeast that are known as grass states, right?
New York State, we are just so fortunate to live in New York State because we have fabulous grass. You know, I always look at those photos of cattle grazing in Texas, and I'm always sort of looking at those photos wondering what the heck they're eating, because it looks like a bunch of, you know, what do you call it, tumbleweeds rolling around out there. And we have this, like, rich, incredible grass. And, like, the wild grass on our property is wild thyme and alfalfa and all these great things.
Can I ask?
The other thing we have in New York State that I just want to finish this thought is New York State still has a rich agricultural infrastructure that, frankly, New England is often dependent on. Mm. New York State has livestock auction houses, feed supply, tractor supply dealers, and some slaughterhouses. We have lost a lot, but we are in a state much better position than New England. And so the New England farmers are often dependent on New York State that cross the line to get the services that they need to farm.
Well, we always say at Heritage Radio Network, better to be this than this. And it sounds like you guys are taking off. Everyone is like, if anyone ever questions Heritage Foods, I'm like, we are the gold standard with one platinum exception, the guys at Flying Pig Farm. I mean, what you guys are doing in New York is absolutely a model, and the more people that could be doing that for rare breeds, the better. I mean, you're doing God's work.
Thanks,
to keep
Patrick.
Those
That's
creatures.
Very kind words.
And sign me up for farm camp. I'd like to be the first one up there.
We are going to do a station break. Those were great guests. Thanks so much for
Thank
being
you.
On. I'm going to do an Edwards drop, and we'll come back with Mario Fantasma.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
This is The Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Shauna Pacifico.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
That's pretty cool.
That's kind of cool.
What a great interview we had with the folks from Flying Farm.
I love them. They're great. They're really great people.
To do rare breeds in New York, you know, the getting across the bridges and through tunnels. And
well, just driving into the city to the farmer's market, just imagine that's like 4 or 5 hours.
I've always thought that the Union Square Green Market should officially, even though it's kind of unofficial, should officially do away with the rule where they demand that the farmer be at the market.
Well, you need something to start. Oh, the farmer be at
the market. I mean, they have so much work to do. I mean, it's so desperate situation for some farmers to make it, and they have to, you know, to have to spend 2-3 days in New York. For some farmers, it works. For others,
I'm sure it's difficult, and there's challenges that we don't even know.
Well, there's also challenges running abattoirs or slaughterhouses.
Yes.
And our next guest is the newest sponsor, the flashing homepage logo sponsor of the radio network. Mario, are you with us?
Yes.
How are you?
I'm fine. How are you doing today?
Oh, my God. You're all nervous. You're slurring your words.
Don't be nervous. I'm more nervous.
Teresa's like, you can come back from that.
We can always rebound.
How are you, Mario? Tell us what part of the world we're calling. For our viewers who don't know, tell us a little bit who you are, where you are. Give us some context of where we're calling.
Okay, I'm Mario Fantasma with Paradise Locker Meats, and we're located here in Trimble, Missouri.
And tell us about a little bit brief history of Paradise Locker Meats and its kind of standing in the community there and the service that it provides the community.
Okay, Paradise Locker Meats was started by the Leiser family in 1946. It was a small butcher shop, and it's actually started in Paradise, Missouri. And I took over the shop in 1995. You know, the shop has always serviced small farms, small farmers, doing the butchering and slaughtering for their home freezers, selling a little bit of retail products, stuff like that. And then we kind of took that to the next stage after we bought the business. And now we are doing a lot of different pigs from different companies or from different farmers across the Midwest here that that Patrick Martin's actually brought in to our shop.
And, hold on, we have a sound effect for that, Mario.
Sure.
Hold on, I think that deserves a crowd cheer. The other option
is
just
for your name.
No, well, these two guys. That's actually just two guys in the back.
Just a couple guys.
We actually have all our sound effects are live. We're about
they
to.
Are. They are.
We're about
There's
to pass.
Two guys.
There's a guy with the foghorn. Hold on. Give him a minute.
Okay.
Anyway. Sorry, I'm done now for at least 5 minutes.
All right. Well, anyway, that's what we're doing. We're continuing to support the small farmers here in our part of the world, and you know, taking care of their products and trying to promote their stuff.
Now, Mario, I have a question for you. You grew up, you know, your early work, I know, was working down in the Kansas City meat docks. What was the name of the company?
I was working for S&S Meat Company.
S&S Meat Companies.
Uh-huh.
So then there you go a few years later, you know, starting your own successful business that, of all things, like in this commodity world, is based off of rare breed, small farmer genetics. I wanted to ask you the question, what's it like? You know, how is it different? Or just speak to the fact that, you know, the primary income of your business is these really rare endangered breeds. Like, how does that work and how is it different from within the industry?
Well, you know, small shops like ours have always taken care of the small farmers. Recently, though, you know, small farmers have been getting into farmers markets and trying to promote their products just so they can get a little bit of an edge. You know, the commodity markets have always underpaid these guys. You know, they don't raise enough. They can't cater to these small rare breeds. Breeds have been genetically, you know, modified over the years and to have, you know, what you may call a cookie cutter animal that goes through the lines that everything works on a large line. So, in fact, it really cuts out these small rare breeds. And unfortunately, it's, you know, by doing that, they've cut out a lot of flavor in the pork and beef, for that matter. I think that, you know, without them, we can't survive. Without the small farmers, we need them to continue to do what they're doing. We need to pay them more money for their labor. You know, it just makes everything work when it comes to sustainable foods.
Mm-hmm. And did you have a question, Sean?
Well, no, I just kind of wanted to say it's kind of, you know, brings up the fact that we need to start prizing these rare breeds and of everything from vegetables to pigs to cows, steer and all that. You know, we buy the best cars and we, you know, buy the most expensive products that we can. But when it comes to food, we want the cheap, and that's it's not working.
Yeah, it hasn't. I think that the products that are out there on the market today have been very tough. I mean, you know, the food is cheap. It's been cheap for a long time, and it's been pretty much at the expense of the farmers. You know, whether it's produce or pork or whatever, whatever the case is. So, you know, these people that work very, very hard, they're losing their farms. They can't pay their bills because they can't bring in enough money.
Well, and at the expense of the people who are eating it, because now we have worse health problems than ever.
I know. It's so disgusting what we put in our bodies. Now, Mario, where do you see Paradise Locker in not 10 years, but like in 150 years?
No, it's 50 years.
Wait, 200 years. No, 200. Mario is a visionary. He literally, I mean, he is a visionary. He's a kind of mentor of mine I look up. And I know that's a far way to project, but describe to me Trimble, Missouri and Paradise Locker Meats 200 years from now. Presuming like everyone has kids and that things continue, like what will the phantasmas be in?
Wow, in 200 years?
150.
Okay. Well, how about 20, 30, 40 years, somewhere in that
okay.
range?
Okay.
That's more reasonable.
More realistic, yeah.
Okay, tell us about 40.
I think that my kids will be here. Their children will be running the business. Hopefully, we'll support the farmers enough that they'll be able to continue to farm. And you know, I look to see this growing. I think more and more people are wanting these types of products. You know, every day we get new people coming in. Hey, you know, do you have locally raised products? You know, what can we get? You know, I don't think this is a fad. This is something that's real. It's happening. It's been growing and growing, and I see it to continue to grow.
And one of the things you guys are doing is you guys welcome chefs and visitors, right? I mean, you've had some sure. pretty stellar chefs come your way, and tell us about the importance of them putting eyes on what you do and face-to-face interactions.
Well, you know, in this day and age, you know how it is. You go to the grocery store and you buy your food and you have no idea where it came from. You know, it's you just kind of take it for granted. Well, it's food. You know, let's go buy it. We're going to eat it. No big deal. When the chefs come here, it kind of opens their eyes. They see the rare breeds coming in. They see the slaughter process and the cutting of all the pigs and you know, it kind of puts things in perspective, especially when they get to go out and see the farms. They actually go visit these farmers and just kind of gets that little one-on-one thing going on, you know. It's really nice, I think. They really enjoyed their trip. The last group that came in enjoyed their trip, and we got some really great emails back from them, and we're just really proud to have them there.
So how does your slaughtering differ from the large commodity places, and is it more humane, and what's the difference between the two?
Yeah, we are actually certified under USDA for humane handling, also AWI and certified humane. So we have two other sources that come in and certify us. Plus, we have an ongoing practice at our shop on humane slaughter. Our HACCP person goes back once a month and does reviews and checks on to make sure that our guys are doing what they're supposed to be doing. We're all supposed to be doing what we're supposed to be doing to under the humane part. And I'm sorry, the other part.
Well, what's the difference between the two? Is it?
Yeah, what happens when you kill a pig versus when Smithfield kills a pig?
Well, you know, they're killing 18,000 head a day. We only can kill maybe 70 to 80 head a day. So I think the attention to detail is greater on our part. Not to say that they're doing a bad job, and that's not what I'm trying to say here. All I'm saying is that you know, we're more of a hands-on. We're not as automated as those places. So
what machinery do you use versus what they use, for instance?
You know, we have just smaller equipment that creates more labor, physical labor. When it comes to doing the actual job, we actually have six guys running the slaughter floor. So it just takes a little more time for us to do it.
What are their names?
well, you have Alfonso and you have
Alfonso, he's their leader.
I can't remember my guys.
Alfonso is their leader, right?
Yeah, he's the head guy.
Wow,
and then
Alfonso.
We have Justin Crockett, and then
does he live in Kearney?
And Raul and
so what number do you think that it you get to whenever you start losing attention to detail?
You know, I don't think there is a number. You know, what we can do in our shop, we're limited just because of our space and our size. You know, if we ran, you know, 70 to 80 head a day for 5 days and that's all we did was pigs, then, you know, that would be our limit. But, you know, we're going to treat everything the same. And because we do other farmers' products, you know, individuals, we have to, and we will always take care of those folks, you know, regardless. Mm-hmm. So
I would say, you know, the way Mario does it, there is no real limit to where it can go, as long as the number.
Can he do 18,000 and keep attention to detail?
If they had,
I don't think so.
If they had 30,000 employees in middle management, I mean, it's not to say that the.
But if somebody like him can do it, why can't the other people do it?
Well, because that's the thing is, I personally think those big guys cross a line where greed seeps into their decision making, and they start to get greedy. It's just that simple. They cut corners. They're like, we could do it with 6 guys instead of 13, even though the animals are going to have to be hanging upside down for an hour. We can overlook that, you know, and Mario really doesn't overlook anything. In fact, you've recently invested in larger pens, right, for your animals to be held?
Yeah, we built some larger pens, you know, especially during the summertime. We have feeders and waterers out there for them. We do, when it gets too hot, we have misting fans for them. You know, and I think a lot of larger places do the same thing. You know, it's just on larger scales.
Can you rank the breeds in terms of desirability for a slaughterhouse to have to butcher them?
I think, you know, obviously the white pigs or the genetically modified pigs are probably the easiest to slaughter, easiest on the equipment. You know, we get a lot of different breeds.
How would you organize the rare breeds? I mean, I know, which are the ones you really that cause your scalder problems?
Yeah, the Duroc's are in. Sorry, Craig. Craig Goody's our Duroc farmer.
And now, what about the Tamworths?
The Tamworths aren't quite as bad as the Duroc's. These are all red-haired hogs. The Duroc's carry a very, very hard hair on them, so it's difficult to get the hair off of them. You know, the Berkshires, even though they're black, they seem to clean up better than the rest of them do. But
in your opinion, everybody says the Berkshire is the best tasting pig, but I feel that it's hard to pinpoint. What's your favorite?
You know, I'll have to tell you, you know, I like them all. I mean, what
come
what I
on.
Think,
we're not asking your favorite farmer.
Yeah, not your farmer, your
just
favorite tasting.
I can't. Hold on, Mario.
So
this
I've
is.
Had, you know, I've had great bacon out of Duroc's. I've had excellent pork chops out of Berkshire. I think each good breed answer. Has its own individual characteristic, very you know, dramatic. When it comes to what's good out of the pig. I think they all develop really nice products.
Good answer, Mario. Because you don't want Craig to be like, I refuse to deliver there.
No.
You're biased.
Well, I want to say this, Mario.
This is Joe Bastianich, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network.
And then we should also thank our boy Sam, who is a big sponsor. Hold on.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
And now, very soon, Paradise Locker Meats will be a link on our website.
Maybe a sound effect.
Yeah, maybe a sound effect, Mario.
Yeah, like a
he's got a
something.
Good voice.
Did you ever think, yeah, you should be the sound effect, Mario?
Okay, I'll do it for you, okay?
Now, Mario, here's I'm sorry to confront you on air. Wasn't there a promise of a certain boar's head being put onto a certain pallet sent
well, yeah,
to a
was.
Certain city? For a certain radio studio?
It's on its way.
Oh, all right. Well, is
it'll
it...
Be on, it'll either be on next week's truck or the following week's truck.
I want to know how far it is as the crow flies. All right. Well, Mario, you've been awesome as per usual. So thanks for coming on.
Well, thank you for having me.
This is your second time, right?
Yeah, this is the second time we've been on, yeah.
You're a veteran. And next time you come to New York at the end of the summer or whatever, we'll go to Back 40.
Taste hey, sounds- Jowl back Nuggets. 40.
Absolutely. Yeah, I can't wait.
They're good.
I need to eat some of this good food, though. You know, we just cut it up. Occasionally we get to eat some of it, but, you know,
yeah, Mario,
what the chefs do with this stuff is incredible.
So. You're really wasting away.
I know.
All right, Mario, I'll talk to you on Monday.
All right, very good. Yes, take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, well, we're going to take a 30-second break after that funny interview and talk with Kim Mueller from Real Food Nation.
Santa Fe.
Oh.
You're listening to the Heritage Radio Network. Today's program was brought to you by Edwards of Surrey, Virginia. www.edwardsvaham.com.
Thanks, Nat. This is the main course. I'm Patrick Martins.
And I'm Shauna Pacifico.
Sitting in for Katie Kiefer. There's a restaurant named
Pacifico. Sitting in for Katie Kiefer.
There's a restaurant named Pacifico in like Cobble Hill or something. Is that yours?
No. No, I work at Back 40.
We're at, that's what Peter needs to hear. We are here being produced by Heather Hyman and engineered by EJ Dukoski, who also does a lot of our lovely calendar work.
I love the calendar.
Yeah?
It's a big topic of conversation among my cooks.
Really? Uh-huh. They get all the jokes they can out of each new breed. well, our final guest is Kim Mueller, a Santa Fe resident. Kim, are you on the phone with us?
Yes, I am.
Welcome. This is your first time on the network, huh?
Yes, it is.
Hi.
Awesome.
Hello.
So tell us about your restaurant, Real Food Nation, and how you came to it.
Well, it's a relatively new restaurant. We opened, I believe it was March 30th. It was a good 2 years or so in the making. The owners.
March 30th this year?
Yes. Huh. Yeah.
Before that, Kim was at La Mancha, another.
I was.
Okay.
Andrew McLaughlin, who's a pretty well known pastry chef, and his wife, Blythe Timken, have been working on this project for a good couple of years. And we're located in this really cool old gas station.
Hmm.
A little bit outside of Santa Fe.
Is it a working gas station?
Does it
well,
still
not
smell
anymore,
like gas?
But it was.
It's just and, gas for the body.
Exactly, yes. We're just fuel
for the
bodies
soul?
Now, no cars.
Fuel for the soul.
That's right. So it's a nice piece of property. There was a gas station and a restaurant, and there was sort of this family feud going on, and ultimately the whole property closed down and sat vacant for a couple years, And so they purchased this land and refurbished the gas station. And
what kind of food do you guys make there?
I'm sorry?
What kind of food do you make there?
Well, we're a little bit sort of seasonal and very clean. It doesn't fit into any particular category. The style of the restaurant is pretty casual. It's basically a counter service kind of situation. So we're sort of along the lines of a upscale deli, almost. They travel around Europe a lot and sort of looked at the traiteurs and those kind of operations in France and other.
Oh, places. Traiteurs. Guys, are you tagging back there? Heather, it doesn't look like it. Mark is coming in acting all prima donna. She's like, break down that wall. No, but I did want
to... So we do a lot of, you know, mostly seasonal, try to stay true to that right now.
What
we,
is a traiteur? A traiteur?
Traiteur basically is sort of the French version of a deli, is my understanding, and I, it's usually ready-to-go food, prepared food, salad, sandwiches, and that's kind of what we do, a variety of sandwiches and salads every day, usually six sandwiches, six fresh salads. We do a nice breakfast burrito, which is really big in these, you know, this part of the world.
Now, how has your restaurant been affected by the Farm to Restaurant Project, which is a sub-project of the Santa Fe Alliance, correct?
Right. Santa Fe Alliance was started to really promote the support of local businesses in all realms. And then the Farm to Restaurant Project is the food and farming, you know, aspect of the Santa Fe Alliance. They have a lot of other programs, but this one specifically is geared to match, you know, restaurants and farms and really promote the use of local, locally grown produce and other products by local restaurants. Right now there's about 27 restaurants that are members of the Farm to Restaurant Project, which is, you know, maybe 10% of our restaurant base here. So it's not, you know, it's not big. Unfortunately, a lot of the really big restaurants have not signed on to this program. So
how many restaurants in your area, in your immediate area, are?
I'm sorry.
How many restaurants in the immediate area are signed on?
How many are part of the project?
Well, we have there's 27 restaurants that are, you know, paid members of this project. We sit a little bit outside of downtown, so we're the only one, you know, where we are. I mean, Santa Fe, once you get outside of the city, is fairly rural.
What's so that place where Deborah Madison lives?
Well, we're in between Santa Fe and where Deb and Patrick live. We're in a little, adjacent to a little subdivision called El Dorado, which is where I happen to live. And it's about, you know, we're about 8 miles from the center of Santa Fe.
And do people still ride horses back and forth in that
area?
Yeah,
actually, we have a few people that show up on their horses, and I haven't seen this personally, but I've been told that we've even had a couple guys on horses come through the drive-up window. So
really?
Only in Santa Fe.
That's very different for us city folk.
Were you in the
folk.
Movie No Country for Old Men?
I was not in it, but I have seen it, yes.
What a
great movie.
Oh, what
little violent for me, but very good.
Actually, not that violent. I mean, the style was an original way of killing people, but I mean, compared to movies nowadays. Now,
yeah.
You're from the similar terrain, kind of wind-torn, rough, like, I mean, what are some of the most creative food survival stories you've heard, like, from that area?
What just grows because there that doesn't grow anywhere else?
Well, obviously, New Mexico is known for chili. So that's our biggest, you know, unlike California, where marijuana is the largest cash crop, I think in New Mexico it's green chili. So, and that's mostly in the southern half of the state. But the southern part of New Mexico is big time, you know, green chili country. And then we have a fair amount of green chili grown, you know, up here in the northern part. There's a couple farmers who have quite a lot of green chili.
That's for the hot chili.
Exactly. So that's our biggest claim to fame here, obviously, is green chili. And then
and anything unusual that's not quite big but maybe won't see other places?
Like, don't you get Sayuro syrup out of cacti?
You know, well, I don't know. We don't have saguaros here. That's in southern Arizona. That's the Sonoran Desert. But
interesting.
We do get, you know, we have some interesting local honeys that come from chamisa and some of the different wildflowers and junipers and trees. We have amazing honey here, and some good. You know, I'm kind of amazed coming from California that there's a fair amount of really great fruit being grown here, which is, you know, apples obviously are a good cool weather crop and we get good apples, but we have amazing peaches here when the weather is right in the spring, and some of the best peaches I've ever eaten in my entire life. Cherries. So there are things that kind of, it surprises me that how well they do, but we're, you know, we have very volatile weather here, so one storm in the spring can wipe out the entire peach and cherry crop.
I noticed that about my mood swings too, those storms. Like one storm can like wipe out a relationship. No, but
the weather here is really
volatile.
Well, we're having problems with our tomatoes here. I don't know if you've
this has been one of the wettest everyone has just broke into urban farming. It's like breaking into the real estate business after like a big economic meltdown.
Yeah, it's, well, everybody's got gardens going. I mean, mine's the biggest I've had in the 10 years I've lived in my house, and we have a ton of land, and we just sort of last year and this year finally, you know, planted a small garden, and so I'm anxiously awaiting tomatoes. And last year I had a garden, and July 3rd we had a massive hailstorm that reduced my little garden to twigs, which broke
my
heart.
Oh, my God. Well, you've been a great guest. Thank you so much, Kim, for being with us. And I really hope that you continue to buy from Heritage. And thank you, Shauna.
I'm a huge fan.
Oh, no, thanks for having me today.
You've been an awesome guest, host. I love your restaurant, so hopefully you'll be a big part of the Heritage Radio Network.
I hope so.
All right. Well, we will be back next week with the main course. And coming up is the Q Report, which is focusing on beer. And this has been sponsored by Sam Edwards, Heritage Radio Network, at Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Yay.